Okay, everyone, so let's get started on the Q&A here. And there's lots of questions here, which is great to see what happens tonight. Dear Venerable Ajahn Brahmali, if the Noble Eightfold Path is sequential, how does right livelihood lead onto or support right effort? Thank you so much for your tireless energy, patience, and kindness in teaching a slave of the Dhamma, and hope your cold gets better soon. With lots of meta. It's much better already, so that's great. There's only one day that it was really bad, now it's already getting better. So I apologize for coughing a little bit during the meditation, but that's really the only small problem that remains. So it is basically sequential, the Noble Eightfold Path, I think you can see that basic sequence in what I was talking about earlier today. But the three factors of right speech and right action and right livelihood, they are really, I don't think there is much sequence in those three. They are basically kind of part of the idea of morality. You can always perhaps make out the sequence there as well if you really want to. But I think that sequence is slightly more artificial. That's basically about morality, and the morality of how we live, how we act, and how we speak comes before the morality of the mind, which is the right effort. Yeah, so you could maybe argue that from right action, first of all, you have to commit to right action. Once you have committed to right action, it becomes natural to commit to right livelihood afterwards. Yeah, because right livelihood is like a sub-factor of right action. You don't first commit to right livelihood and then to right action. Usually right action comes first. And then this is how you then purify all the aspects of morality. Yeah. So really, you could also argue that right action is probably sufficient in its own right. Right morality there is really just a slight right livelihood is only a small refinement on the idea of right action. But actually, all you really need to keep in mind is the idea of right action, and it should be all right. That should be good enough. So that is really all I have to say on that one. Okay. Dear Ajahn, thank you for explaining these great teachings to us so patiently. From the two suttas below, I can see that knowledge of the Four Noble Truths leads to the removal of lust, hatred, and delusion. Sanyutta Nikaya 45.4, the Brahmin A right view, when developed, has its final goal, removal of greed, hatred, and delusion, or lust, hatred, and delusion. The analysis, and what is the right view? Knowledge of the Four Noble Truths. Then it was mentioned that one may not fully understand the Four Noble Truths unless one is an arahant. If so, does it mean that only an arahant has fully eliminated lust, hatred, and delusion? Thank you, Ajahn Mehta. Yes, that is exactly what it means. The point here is not actually that the Four Noble Truths do lead to, ultimately, lead to knowledge of the Four Noble Truths do lead to the removal of, I prefer, desire, ill will, and delusion. But you actually understand the Four Noble Truths when you become a stream enter. That's when you have the full understanding of them. And it says in that sutta that you develop and cultivate that. And when you develop and cultivate it, that's when it leads to the final removal of these things. Yeah. So first of all, you have the insight into them. Then you practice accordingly. And then ultimately the elimination happens as a consequence. So it's kind of way down the path. So basically you become an arahant. You do actually fully understand the Four Noble Truths before you become an arahant. Stream entry is enough. Stream entry is when your view gets rectified. You see things in the right way. The stream entry is called the dittipatta in the sutta. Dittipatta means attained to view. You have reached right view. You see things in accordance with reality. This is kind of the Buddhist perspective on this. Yeah, that happens at that point. But that already is way down. It's actually a long way down for most people to become a stream mentor. Yeah, many people say, oh, I'd like to become a stream mentor in this life, so I'm kind of safe. And great. But remember that it's not, you have to actually it takes a lot of commitment and perseverance to get to that point. Before you come to Sri Mentor, you have to get your samadhi together. Yeah? Samadhi is the cause for seeing things according to reality. And samadhi already, if you have some samadhi, you are already, you know, it feels wonderful. It feels absolutely astonishing. It feels like your life has already been turned upside down when you get to samadhi. You have this incredible unification of mind, this extraordinary bliss inside, and all of these things happening already. So already you have gone a long way on the path. So enjoy, instead of focusing too much on these kind of goals that often are far off, enjoy what you have already. Yeah, enjoy the peace that you get. Enjoy if you do get a bit of happiness and piti sukha. It's wonderful. Enjoy that. Don't think too much about the future, what's coming way down the track. Because if you think too much about that, you won't enjoy the path so much. There was too much craving there, too much desire for moving ahead towards something which is still out of reach. So enjoy what you have. When you enjoy what you have already, that actually is the best way to move forward. Why? Because you're eliminating the desire. You're enjoying what you have now. So go deeper into the present moment. Have more contentment with what you already have. Then these things will start to come together. Yeah, I'm always a little bit afraid because there is a lot of, you know, spiritual, I mentioned this yesterday, spiritual materialism around. People wanting to have this, wanting to have that, people giving you a certificate that you are a stream mentor and these kind of things. And really, it is not. I think it is really unfortunate because it leads to the wrong ideas. Enjoy what you have already. The more you do that, the more encouraged you will be that this path is really very interesting and very, very satisfying. And the fact that you can go much, much deeper than you are already, it just makes it even more interesting and more satisfying in a sense. Okay. Oh, okay. I thought that was a question, but it wasn't. Okay. Dear Ajahn, how should a person train himself to be able to see his past lives? Thank you. How should you train yourself to be able to see your past lives? Okay, what you should do is get yourself into a very profound state of samadhi. Yeah, really, really deep samadhi. So deep that you lose complete contact with the world and you're kind of really just completely inside of yourself. You're blissing out, you feel kind of unified with the universe. Everything has become one. There's no duality anymore. And then that is the point where your mind is so powerful that then you can direct your mind to your past lives. You can, you know, think back in this life to your earliest point, and then you can make the jump over into past lives. And then you can recall them sequentially, one after the other, to see how you move from one life to the next one and how eventually you end up in this life. So this is kind of the way that is described in the suttas, really. But you have to have really powerful samadhi to be able to do this, very powerful meditation. Sometimes people have all kinds of visions in the meditation. Yeah, people see things, you see kind of, maybe you see yourself in a landscape, you see yourself in a certain place. And very often people interpret this to be past lives. But if it is a vision that you have in your meditation practice, a vision that is prior to deep meditation, something you get when you become a little bit peaceful, it is very unreliable. You don't really know what it actually means. The problem with the mind is that the mind is very powerful. The mind can make up all sorts of things, all kinds of visions, sounds, almost anything. And because of the power, the creative activity of the mind, it's very difficult to know whether it's just the creative activity of the mind or actually it is a real memory of the past life. 90% of the time, it is just the creative activity of the mind. Occasionally, you may get some glimpse into the past, into a past life, but actually it's quite unusual. So some people have very visual minds that allow them, you know, all these things start to happen once they become peaceful. But there isn't really much wisdom to be had in that, apart from seeing how powerful the mind is in creating things. and maybe have a bit of entertainment for a while. So, you know, just to kind of enjoy yourself a little bit and see, kind of have a look at the scenery, see what's going on. You see, wow, this is astonishing. It's like seeing all kind of stuff. But after a while, you sort of move further because you want to go further on the path. There are other ways of remembering past lives. There are some people who do past life regressions. Yeah, hypnotic regressions, these kind of things. Sometimes they work, often they don't. It's very hard to know. But I've heard of cases of people who have had very detailed recollection of past lives, and then later on they have kind of checked if such a person existed using existing records of people that are in existence of people from the past. And sometimes they have been very close matches, and you wonder whether actually they did remember their own past lives through hypnotic regression. But these things are very unreliable, and they are unreliable because the mind is has a very powerful creative ability, and it creates all of these kind of things. So really the only reliable way of remembering your past life is to go into very deep meditation, and then you remember it just as you remember your past in this life, but with far greater clarity. And you can see the sequence of things. Yeah, you can see how you live in one life, how you move from that life into the next one. You can see the causal sequence ending up in the present life. And it's when you have this broad overview with great clarity, yeah, like a memory in the present life, except far more powerful, that is when you will know when it is absolutely certain. This is just part or parcel of what happens with these things. So it is kind of way down the track, yeah? So if you don't see your past lives on this retreat, don't despair because of that, yeah? Come back next year and try again, and then we'll see. Eventually you'll get there. Thank you, Ajahn, for teaching us the suttas well explained, Sadhu times three. In the Metta Sutta, the sentence, not busy with duties and frugal in the ways, please explain the word frugal in this context. Appakicho sallahukavuti. Appakicho is the Pali word. Not busy with duties. Appakicho doesn't actually mean busy with duties. Is that what it says in this book? Oh, wrong translation. Yeah, we are. No, let's see. Let's see what it says here. Where is it again now? There it is. Not busy with duties. Appakicho. The word appakicho does not actually mean not busy with duties. I didn't know we had that. And this is the wrong book, isn't it? This is the right one. We got to get the right one here. Not same thing in both of them. Unburn it. Upper kitchen means having few duties. Yeah, that's what it actually means. Yeah. Upper is few. Yeah. Unburn it. That's actually wrong. Yeah. That's what I say. Anyway, that's my feeling of this. Appakicho means having few duties. Yeah, so I guess not busy with duties isn't too bad. It's kind of almost there, but actually it means having few duties. Appa is few, kicho is duties or obligations or work or whatever. And then the other word here is salaha hukavuti. Salahukavuti. Lahu means light. Salvuti means to live. You live in a light way. Yeah, that's kind of actually what it means, this one here. So, frugal in their ways, living lightly, that is might be the implication of that. So, I think the point is just to have a simple life, yeah? Not to kind of live in a complicated way, not to have too many demands on the world around you. And of course, this is true especially for monastics, but also a very useful way of thinking about life as a layperson. If you live simply, if you just have your ordinary life and you don't have so many demands of the world around you, it actually lessens a lot of the the desires and all the problems in the mind, and it makes life so much easier when you live in that way. You have enough to kind of to get by, to live, but you don't actually have this kind of great desires for always going, getting more, always doing more, having more things. So frugality is actually a great thing. One of the, you know, when I see some of the greatest monks or monastics around, often they live very, very simple lives. There is one monk I know about, very famous. He was a monk in Sri Lanka, and he would just be wandering on Tudong. Tudong were doing Dutanga practices. He would walk around the island of Sri Lanka all the time, and he would carry all his belongings with him. Yeah, and when you looked at him, there was no belongings. He had a small bag, and he had an alms bowl. That was pretty much it. And he would just walk around. Yeah, very, very frugal, very, very simple. And then he would receive alms in the villages, and when he would find a nice place to meditate, he would just sit down. So easy, yeah, when you have it like that. It's such a simple life. In the suttas, and this is a passage I will not be looking at this time, there is a passage on the idea of contentment. And it says there that as a monastic, you should be just like a bird with the wings as its only burden. Yeah, the wings as your only burden. So you should only really have a robe and an alms bowl to maintain your stomach and to look after your body. And that's all you need. Bird, like a bird with the wings as its only burden. The wings aren't really a burden. If the bird hasn't got wings, it can't do very much. But it's a little burden. Just like it's a tiny little burden left, but it's a burden required to sustain your life, to live. And then you walk around with that as your only burden. That is kind of the monastic ideal. I'm not going to tell you how I live, because that would get very embarrassing, because it's not quite up to that ideal, unfortunately. But it's still quite a simple life. Yeah, I have a small little kuti in the forest, small little hut. It's about 7 square meters. And I must admit, I have a few books in there. Pali books, that kind of stuff. But apart from that, there isn't that much in my little kuti. And it's very nice. You know, one of the nice things, when I sometimes go into Perth, and sometimes you travel along the riverfront, and these very expensive properties, you see these massive mansions. And each mansion has maybe 0.5 meter between the next mansion because the property is so expensive. Yeah, you have to maximize, build the maximum size of house on that mansion. And when I see that, I think, I would never want to live there. You know, I would much rather live in a tiny kuti in the forest on 7 square meters with land around it. My kuti, when I sit in my kuti, I can't see any other hut. I can't see anyone else. I'm completely by myself. And it's so wonderful, it's a great privilege to be able to live like that. It's a wonderful thing. I wouldn't want to live in any other way. But to be able to do that, you have to be quite frugal. Otherwise you need kind of places to store all your stuff, etc. But the idea that frugality is great, but even better than frugality, to live in a light way, it says here, is to just to be content with what you have. Because if you are content, contentment is the first step in reducing desires. If you are content, it means you don't want any more. So the desires are going down. The mental defilements are going down as a consequence. So contentment is really the most important thing, not always moving towards something else. Okay, I hope that was roughly what you were asking. If not, please come back to it tomorrow. Okay. Greetings, Ajahn. Could you please describe in more detail how to observe the breath, stay with the breath? Does one observe the beginning of the breath and stay with the breath till it falls away? I am fairly new to meditation. Thank you. Okay. So the idea here is not to kind of have too many ideas of how to observe the breath. The idea, rather, is to allow the observation almost to happen by itself. So you start off with just the awareness of whether the breath is going in and out. All you are aware of is whether the breath is going in, the breath is going out. So it's a very simple awareness to start with. And as the mind calms down and becomes more peaceful, your awareness will expand and you are able to see more of that breath. So it's a gradual process. It's important not to try to, if you try too hard to be aware of the beginning, the middle, and the end, and all of this kind of things, it's too much trying in that. Don't do the trying. Just sit back and allow the process to happen. And this is what the Buddha says when he talks about not using the willpower, na cetanaya karaniya, not to be done through an act of will. It means that the whole process, you just sit back and you allow it to happen. You nudge your mind a little bit, yeah? You nudge your mind a little bit to get into the positive state, to feel kind of the good atmosphere, and that, you know, they have a positive sensation about being on this retreat. So you nudge your mind a little bit in that sense, but you don't do very much. The rest is just a process that happens by itself. Yeah, you allow yourself to become peaceful. You allow things to fall away. You just enjoy. Wow, it's so wonderful to be here. All the burdens of my ordinary life are gone. Yeah, this is what I came here for. This is so wonderful. All these nice people around me. All these beautiful teachings from the Buddha. Yeah, what a wonderful thing it is. And when you get into that right mood, when you get into the right attitude, because you're feeling positive, mindfulness happens by itself. You come into the present moment. Things fall away. And as you emerge into the present moment, the breath is already there, because the breath is what is here. It's only when you're thinking a lot that the breath kind of falls away. You don't know what's happening. The breath is already there. And when the breath is there, just notice the breath is there. Okay, the breath is going in, the breath is going out. Yeah. So you're staying with the breath. It's almost automatic. It happens by itself. And then the breath leaves you again because you are thinking a bit again. And then it comes back. And as you allow the mind to calm down in this way, your awareness of the breath starts to strengthen and becomes more powerful. And you start to see more. You're not doing this. You're not doing anything. You're allowing this to happen. And this is what makes the meditation so beautiful, because it's so easy, it is so natural, it feels so good. The more force and effort, the more you try to make this happen, the more unpleasant it often becomes. If the breath is not nice to watch, and many people, you probably have found that sometimes the breath is not really enjoyable. Why isn't it enjoyable? It's because you're putting too much force into it. Yeah, that's why it's not really enjoyable. So take a step back again. Yeah, allow mindfulness to become a bit stronger. Then allow the breath to come to you. It's a very useful perception to think of it as allowing the breath to come to you rather than you going to the breath. Because if you go to the breath, there is a degree of will there involved in it. But if the breath comes to you, there is no will. You're just passive. You're a passenger. Yeah, you're not doing anything. Being a passenger is so easy rather than being the driver. So that's why the monks, we have all these drivers that drive us around. The anagarikas, yeah, the drivers. Because passenger is so nice, yeah. Nicholas takes me this way, takes me that way. It's very, very, very nice. Because passenger is, you can just relax. You can just chill. You don't have to force your attention on anything. It's really good to be a passenger. So try to be the passenger of your meditation. All we really need to do is nudge the mind a little bit this way and that way. If you see some bad thoughts coming up, okay, then you have to be a little bit careful. Often what happens if you have some bad thoughts coming up, you just observe them and they pass away. If you can't observe them and they don't pass away, then you may have to use something to counteract the negative thoughts. Yeah, we'll talk more about that later on. But generally speaking, just enjoy. Okay, see what happens. If you wish, you're more than welcome to come and have a chat with me about that in the interviews as well, if you like. Okay, Ajahn, if a student wants to find a particular sutta to help answer a particular issue, such as desire, tension with relatives, anger antidotes, how do they research or look for an index, given there is so much material. Much met at your throat and nasal passage. You are the best, okay. Very good. Okay, so how do you do that? How do you actually... And this is not so easy, because the suttas are not really characterized in that. But usually the suttas, they have indices at the back. Yeah, the four Nikayas in English, they are kind of four fairly large books, and they all have indices in the back. So if you look in the back, and you can look under desire or look under anger, you can find answers to these questions. But one of the things that I like to do on this retreat is focus on those suttas that are directly related to how to deal with the mind. Yeah, basically everybody has the same kind of problems. That's the reality of it. Everybody thinks that they're different, but I have bad news for you. You're not that different, yeah? we are basically the same. We have the same problems. We have the same desires. We want to head in the same direction. And that is why the Buddha's teachings are so universal. That's why they're applicable to everyone, because basically we are the same. So everybody has too much. It's very rare to find someone who has no problems at all with anger or ill will. Everybody has a little bit of that. And that's why it's always useful to talk, bring out some suttas that helps you to deal with those issues. Everybody, even more people, have problems with desires. Yeah, desires always interfere in meditation practice and all of these kind of things. So dealing with that is also important. I often talk about that as well on these retreats. We'll have a look at some suttas later on. But most important is to deal with the ill will, because that is kind of a root problem and very powerful problem. Leads to lots of difficulties in the world between us and our family members and friends and whatever, because it is such a disruptive force in our relation with other people. So deal with the ill will, deal with the anger. That is by far the most important thing. The desire is more difficult to deal with, but that too is good to at least get to grips with to some extent. Tension with relatives. I don't think there is any sutta specifically on that topic, but basically these are the kind of things that you have general topics in the suttas, and those general topics will help you to deal with things like tension with relatives. So one of the powerful ways of dealing with something like that, because I guess, I don't know, maybe this is your problem since you're mentioning it, so I might as well talk a little bit about that one, because I'm not going to come back to that later on. How do we deal with tension with relatives? And one of the really powerful teachings in the suttas, one of the most profound aspects of the Buddhist path, is the idea of no self. Yeah, and the idea of non-self or no-self has very practical implications as well. This is very much part of the deepest aspect of Buddhism, but it also has very practical implications. As I was saying yesterday, it means that we are essentially the sum total of the conditions and causes and influences and environment that works on us. So because we are, that's what we are, it means that we often don't have there's a limit to how much control we have over ourselves. Yeah, sometimes people say something and we get angry. Sometimes people, something else happens and we react in a certain way. And we can't really stop ourselves because the program that we are running on is so strong. It's a program that comes from deep in the past sometime, maybe in the past lives, and it's playing out again and again and again. So because of that, once you start to understand this idea of non-self, you start to understand that people around you are also just that. They are programmed to act in a certain way. And this is called their habits. This is called their conditioning from the past. And when you realize that in other people, especially if it is your relatives, it's very useful to see this. Once you realize that they are just playing out these old programs from the past, they probably don't want to be like that. They probably want to be different. Yeah, we all want to be kind if we possibly can. We all want to be as good as we possibly can, but sometimes we're unable to do that. Once you see that in your relatives and your friends, that they are the victims of the conditioning, they can't be who they want to be. If they are the victims of their conditioning, how are you going to feel about them? You're going to have more compassion. You're going to have more sympathy. You're going to have more metta, because you know that they are the first victim of their state of mind or their habits or whatever it is. So this is how you start to deal with your relatives. It's very, very useful to deal with one's relatives, because these are the people who are closest to us. Yeah. So if you're able to deal with your relatives, you can deal with almost anyone else. Because they are so close to us, there's more friction, and that causes more difficulties very often. So if you can deal with them, wow, you can deal with almost anyone. To be able to do this, sometimes you need a bit of distance. And this is why it's great to come on a retreat every now and again. If you are around someone all the time, yeah, it's very hard to kind of get enough space to be able to deal with that. So coming on a retreat is great. It gives you the space to readjust and think about things in a different way. You come here, it gives you the chance to withdraw a little bit, to let the feelings kind of calm down a little bit and get a new perspective. Think about it in a different way. Then when you come back afterwards, then you can kind of deal with those relatives in a different way, with more compassion and kindness and all of these kind of things. So this is the way to do this. It's a gradual thing. It takes time, but it actually is very powerful. That is kind of a standard advice, and this is also the kind of advice you find in the suttas. It is not easy, but if you are really committed and if you persevere, you will succeed. Okay, good. Next one now. Please don't... Okay. Okay. I'll let that is a private message to me, so I can't read it out. So I'm just going to have to put it here on the one side. Yeah. Okay. Very good. Next one. Hi, Bhante. Where can I find in the suttas comparing stream entry to light and lightning? Okay, I think that's in the Anguttara Threes. If you go to the Anguttara Threes, I think there is a sutta which talks about becoming a stream entry. It's like the lightning, bang, flash, you see the truth for the first time. And becoming an arahant is like being a diamond or something like that. So go to the Anguttara Nikaya, the numerical discourses, go to the index, there's an index of similes and metaphors. Go to lightning there, and you will probably find it quite easily. Thank you very much. Okay, you are most welcome. Invisible and celestial and wholesome metta for you. Okay, wow, that's really pretty cool. Okay, thank you very much for that. Sorry, me again. I notice some people's study don't produce obvious wholesome conduct, or there is no obvious improvement of personality traits and habits. Why is that? How to avoid? Well, it depends why you study, what you study for, This is kind of the problem there. Some people study because they are restless, Buddhism is kind of cool, so because I got a bit of spare time, I'm going to study a bit of Buddhist suttas. There's different reasons why people study things. Or, you find Buddhism interesting as an intellectual exercise. You're one of these kind of old, like back in the 19th century when the Europeans started to become interested in the Dhamma, probably the Australians as well for that matter, they started to think about the Dhamma. Very interesting, And they would sit in their armchairs and they would smoke their pipes and they would contemplate dependent origination. Dependent origination, Very interesting, It's the wrong way, There was no real interest in practicing these teachings. It was all intellectual stuff because that was the European tradition. The European tradition was like a thinking tradition. There wasn't very much of a contemplative tradition where you would meditate on this kind of thing. And that was a big problem. So it depends why you are doing these things. But if you read the suttas for information on how to live, how to practice, what to do with your life, they become incredibly powerful and very, very useful. So it's all about why you do these things. Actually, there was an interesting one of the early translations for jhana. Jhana is the really profound states of samadhi. One of the earliest translations for the word jhana was musing. The word musing means like, I will think, thinking, contemplating, musing. That's what it means. They had a completely wrong idea what jhana was all about. They thought it was kind of contemplating or thinking about things. And that's why you have to be careful when you read translations. You think jhana is musing, it leads you completely astray. You think that the whole path is about thinking out the Dhamma. So you have to be careful sometimes with these translations. So don't go to those translations. Actually, that reminds me of I mentioned yesterday that samadhi these days, how to translate the word samadhi. And one of the recent translations by Ajahn Sujato, he translates samadhi as immersion. Because you are like you immerse something in water. You're completely covered by something. And then Ajahn Brahm says stillness is a good translation. So which one is it? very different words. Yeah, is one word better than the other one? What other words are there for samadhi? Concentration is the classic one, yeah, but that has been banned by Ajahn Brahm, so I can't use that one. Yeah, it's like a bit like swearing in Buddhist circles to use concentration now. So please don't use concentration. And actually, Ajahn Brahm has a very good point because it really gives the wrong impression. So what about immersion? And I think immersion actually is quite a good translation, to be honest, because one of the common translations now for jhana is absorption. Absorption, you are absorbed within yourself. You have lost contact with the outer world. You are completely inside of yourself. You are absorbed into a particular state. So once you understand what it refers to, it actually makes good sense. Immersion is similar. You are completely immersed within your own little world. There's no contact outside anymore. So I think it is, I think it kind of is basically, it gives the right idea once you understand the idea behind it, what is going on. But I must admit, I actually really like Ajahn Brahm's translation of stillness, and I like it because it is very easy to grasp what is going on. And not only is it easy to grasp, but stillness, it touches you in a deep way. You know what that means, yeah? It has an emotional impact. Immersion and absorption are a little bit intellectual, in my opinion. Yeah, a little bit kind of, okay, they make sense, but they don't draw you, at least for me, I'm talking for myself now, they don't kind of draw you in. They don't have the same emotional impact on me as a word like stillness has. So I like the idea of stillness. The actual meaning of these words, remember, these are specialized meditation vocabulary. So they were used in ancient India in specialized meditation circles. So for that reason, they have very specific meaning that refers to specific states of mind. The actual derivation of these words is not so interesting here, but they refer to these very specific things. And we don't have any vocabulary in the English language which naturally any natural contemplative vocabulary that actually expresses these things quite in the same way. So we have to come up with our own words, yeah? And that's why it gets difficult. So that's why you have to find a word which is ballpark right, gives the right feeling, yeah? And I quite like Ajahn Brahm's word stillness, and that's what I use when I translate these things. Anyway, I'm getting a bit sidetracked from your question here, as usual. When you read the suttas, do it to as a guide to inspire you, to guide you on the path so you understand what you have to do. That is when they are powerful. And if you really use the suttas in that way, they actually will become very powerful in your life. Use them to inspire you to become more kind, to become a better person, to have a better heart, and all of these kind of things. Yeah, and they really can inspire you in that way. The hardest part on the Buddhist path is to persevere and commit to the practice. That is the hardest part. I think all of us, we know basically what we have to do. Yeah, you can summarize the Buddhist teaching in one word, kindness, really. If you can really be kind consistently all the time, you're going to make very, very fast progress on the path. But actually being kind consistently all the time is actually quite difficult. Yeah, it's difficult because the causes outside of us don't always allow us to be kind. They kind of push us in other directions. So to be able to do that, we have to have this commitment and consistency. And really, the way to have commitment and consistency is to always come back to the suttas. Come back to a good Dhamma talk, something that inspires you, yeah? And if you lose your way a little bit, you lose your inspiration a little bit, come back to it again. And sometimes maybe you lose your inspiration in a little bit more in a deeper way. Again, it's okay. Just let it be for a while, then come back to it later on again. So that you kind of renew yourself every now and again. Don't listen to Dhamma talks compulsively, because if you get too much Dhamma, that also can sometimes be bad. Yeah, you get bombarded by all these things all the time. Have a bit of distance as well. Contemplate a bit for yourself. Ask yourself what these things mean in your own life. Make it your own teachings, rather than always external things being kind of pushed into you. Think about them. Make them your personal things. And that is when they become really powerful. When it becomes your personal truth that you know that kindness, compassion, metta is powerful, it makes you happy. Yeah, if that is your personal truth, then it is far more significant than to hear it from some authority which tells you that is the case. When you know it in your own heart, wow, that is when it really works. So this is the difference. The difference is where we come from, coming from the right place. That is when you these things start to work. Okay, dear Ajahn, the stanza we use for reminding the virtues of the Buddha, Itipiso Bhagavan, did this originate from the Kesa Puttiya Sutta? If so, where did the stanzas for virtues of Dhammasangha originate? Much metta to you, Ajahn, thank you. It does not originate from the Kesa Puttiya Sutta, because in the Kesa Puttiya Sutta, it is just like the introduction. Yeah, this is like the narrative introduction. Elsewhere in the suttas, the Buddha says, there are certain ways to give rise to joy, to get your meditation started. Yeah, this is found in the Anguttara Nikaya 6s, for example. The Buddha talks about 6 ways of giving rise to the initial happiness, gladness, and joy in meditation, then carries you forward when you start watching the breath. So the Buddha puts a lot of emphasis on how to give rise to wholesome attitude and wholesome mental states. And these things are called things like sila nusati, recollection of your conduct, your character, your virtue. Yeah, a very important part of how to give rise to good feeling good about yourself. So that is sufficient in its own right, just recalling your good conduct. Often it's automatic. If you live really well, you will tend to feel good about yourself. Chaga nusati, recollection of your generosity. Yeah, so if you have a generous heart, then it's easy again to recall the fact that you have been, you know, supporting various causes and various things. Then you have the 3 anusatis, recollections of the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. And this is really the kind of suttas where this comes from. And the Buddha says, if you're going to recall the Buddha, do it in this way. Yeah, that's where it comes from. And then from there, it has been expanded and used in places also like the Kesya Putta Sutta. But that is not really the original home of this. So if you want to find all of these 3 contemplations, go to this sutta, is I think called the Mahanama Sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya 6s. Mahanama Sutta, something like that. Mahanama is a name. He was a cousin of the Buddha. If you go there, you should be able to find it there. So check it out. And if you can't find it, then contact me at some stage. Come to the interview or whatever, and I will kind of bring it out, and I will kind of let you know exactly where it is, where you can find these things. But actually, these things are fairly common in the suttas, and you should be able to find it fairly easily. Okay. Dear Ajahn, I know the meaning of yoniso manasikara. Good. But what is the meaning of dhatu manasikara? How to do this? Dhatu manasikara? I have no idea, nor do I. At what time do you do this? Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Dhatu manasikara. Dhatu is usually like the relics of the Buddha called dhatus, usually. Yeah? And so maybe what you mean here is attention on the relics of the Buddha. Is that what you mean? This is not a word you find in the suttas. This is a word that probably comes from the commentarial tradition, I would guess. I have never even heard of this word myself, dhatu manasikara, but presumably that is what you mean. And I can imagine that this occurs in the commentaries and later Buddhist literature, that you recall, remember the Buddha, you put attention on perhaps the the remains of the Buddha or something like that. And sometimes people have relics at home, or they have relics on the shrine. We have it in the monastery. There are some relics in this Buddha statue over here, for example. And very often people will bow down to that as a reminder of the Buddha. So, and that is fine. And that maybe is what you mean here by recalling that. But remember that the idea of having the dhatus or having the relics of the Buddha, the idea of that is just to have a reminder that the Buddha really existed. Yeah, he was a real being. If we have a relic of the Buddha, well, he must have existed. So it kind of makes the Buddha more real. It's a bit like when I talk about the Buddha here, you try to make him into a real historical person, because that's obviously who he was. And the relics help you to remind you of that. But remember that relics are just relics. And the Buddha often said that, you know, why do you want to see this body for? This is not how you see the Buddha, by seeing the body of the Buddha. The way to see the Buddha is by practicing the path and then realizing the same things as the Buddha realized. Yeah, that is how you actually realize it. When you see what the Buddha saw, then you understand who the Buddha was. The Buddha doesn't define himself by a physical body. The Buddha defines himself by his mental state. That is what makes a Buddha. When you get the same mental state, then you understand what the Buddha is all about. So forget about all this relic stuff. You know, I must admit, I don't really like all these relics. I think it is, it goes too far. People get obsessed with relics. And the Buddha actually, as I just mentioned now, didn't really encourage that at all. These are just physical remains. What the Buddha wants to do, he wants to see us practice the path, to be kind to each other. That's what he wants us to do. He doesn't want us to be overly obsessed with relics. If you do have some relics of the Buddha and you want to, for as a reminder, good, but don't make it into a into too much. So that is the best I can do on that question, because I'm not entirely 100% sure what you mean. So if you want to give it another try, please do so tomorrow. Dear Ajahn, you've mentioned the intermediate state after death before new birth. I've also noticed that many different cultures hold ceremonies 40 to 50 days after the death of a person. Could you please explain the significance of this period? How long does it usually take until the next birth? And in which cases does one become a ghost? Thank you. Yes, it's quite common. In the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, they have this idea of the bardo, which lasts for 49 days or whatever it is. Yes, they say it's 49 days. Very common, that's what you find in the Tibetan tradition. In the suttas, the Buddha doesn't actually say anything about the length of this interval. And I think the reason why he doesn't say anything about the length, that it will depend enormously on your kamma, what kind of intermediate state you have and how long it goes on for. There are certain types of rebirth. For example, if you get into a very profound state of samadhi, yeah, as you die, you go straight into jhana, you get reborn straight away in the jhana realms. No intermediate state is required at all. If you have done really, really bad karma, you may go straight into a bad state, bang, right away. But for the most common rebirths, probably there is a time gap in between. And I would say that it just varies, yeah, and it's very hard to really pin down exactly how long it goes. While the person is there, it is a bit like a ghostly existence, so very often you can reach them while they are in the intermediate state. It's as if they have a little bit of contact still with their worldly existence. So because of that, that's often when we do the ceremonies for people. We wish them well. We may ask for forgiveness. We may grant forgiveness. We may do little acts of charity on their behalf and say, this is for you, mother. This is for you, father. This is for you, granny and granddad, or even son or daughter, yeah, if we have somebody young who dies. And then we can actually help them in that intermediate existence. And then if they move on and they get reborn as a ghost, we can still help them in that ghostly existence as well afterwards. It is impossible to say how long it usually takes. It varies enormously. In which cases does one become a ghost? It depends on your karma, yeah? So it all depends on how you have lived your life. If you have lived your life not too well, not terribly badly, but kind of semi-badly, you've been a bit dodgy, yeah, dodgy character, then you die, and often if you have very strong attachments, yeah, that attachments will kind of bind you to a certain house, and then you kind of haunt that house for the next two centuries, yeah? Because you can't get out of there anymore. Yeah? This is how you get haunted houses, yeah? Ghosts are attached to the houses. They refuse to leave. So this is one of the fun things about being a Buddhist monk. You become a ghostbuster. This is one of the kind of things we have to do, ghostbusting, yeah? So ghostbusting is good fun. People say, okay, we've got a problem in a house, we think it's a ghost, please ship in the monks and get them to sort out the ghost, yeah? So they give us a nice meal, and when a meal is over, we do some chanting, and we do usually the Metta Sutta, we spread some kindness to the ghost, because usually the reason why, if there really is a ghost in a house, the reason why they're there, the reason is because they are attached to that house. They still find happiness in staying there. So we spread some metta to them to show them that actually you don't need this house to have metta. You can get their other sources of metta. And if they can feel that metta, sometimes they're able to let go and move on into a new existence. Yeah, this is kind of this is the theory behind ghostbusting. Is that interesting? Yeah, the ghostbusting theory. This is theory. And to see it in practice, you have to come to one of the ghostbustings, and see what actually happens. Yeah, this is how it works. So it's very hard to know exactly what is going on. You know, people have a problem. Sometimes it seems to work. They have a problem in the house. You do a bit of ghostbusting and the problem is gone. So presumably it worked, yeah? But it's very difficult to know exactly what is happening. But that is kind of the theory behind this. If you want to avoid becoming a ghost, just live well. Yeah, if you live a good life, you keep the five precepts, you are kind and caring and supporting, you're doing the right things, the chances of becoming a ghost are actually fairly small. Very likely you will become at least a human being, or maybe even something better than that. Okay. Don't tell Ajahn Brahm I taught the secrets about ghostbusting, because these are trade secrets, yeah? So these trade secrets should not be told to anyone. Okay, is the nimitta prerequisite to jhana, or they are separated? Is the nimitta a prerequisite to jhana? It seems that usually they are. Even in the suttas, the one sutta that talks about nimitta is really the Upakalesa Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 128. Upakalesa means like defilements of the mind. And there the Buddha gives a long discourse on very refined defilements of the mind that you have to abandon to go into the jhanas. It's a very nice discourse. Maybe we can do that one of these retreats, one of these years. If I'm still alive, yeah? See what happens. So it seems from that usually the path into jhana is through a nimitta. It's called the obasa in the sutta. Obasa means like a light. Yeah, you have an obasa and you have a rupa. Rupa is a form. You see forms and you see lights. That is basically what nimittas. They're not called nimittas in the suttas, which is interesting, yeah? Because we're used to using the Pali word nimitta, but actually it's not used like that in the suttas. But that is kind of the common parlance these days. But there are different kinds of nimittas. Yeah? Nimitta really just means like, in this case, it just means like an image, or it means like it means something is usually used in the sense of something you see in the mind's eye. And the majority of nimittas, people see all kind of strange stuff. Yeah, they see landscapes, they see all kind of things. And that is not what we mean by nimittas in this case. What we mean by nimittas is more like something very stable and very simple. Usually something that looks a bit like the sun or something like that. Yeah, a powerful, brilliant light kind of thing. That is what we mean by nimittas usually. It's called an obasa in the suttas, a light. So that is the kind of nimitta, and that seems to be, for most people, required to enter the jhana states. It's like you enter it through that nimitta. You go beyond the nimitta, and that's where the jhanas are found. Yes, are they separated? Well, they are separated in that you start off with the nimitta and then you move on to the jhana. Yeah, so you don't. Quite a number of people get nimittas, but the number of people who actually get the jhanas is much smaller, because there's a kind of a gap there for going from the nimitta to the actual jhana itself. Okay. Dear Ajahn, is it time when one listens to Dhamma talks and learns its teachings, one would have made merit? Is it true? That's what he's saying here. Okay. Is it true when one listens to Dhamma talks and learns its teachings, one would have made merit? Have you made merit just by listening to the teachings? I would say the answer is probably no, not really. It's not really. The Buddha talks about three bases for making merit, and the three bases for making merit is chaga, generosity, sila, virtue, and bhavana, meditation practice. These are the three traditional bases for making merit. Making merit here, all it really means is, remember what it means to make merit. It means to create happiness for yourself. That's what it means. So how do you know that you have made merit? Well, you know, if you do an act of kindness and you feel happy about it afterwards, you made merit. That's what it means, yeah? Simple as that. And because this leaves an imprint on your mind, you take that also into the future lives. Yeah, so this is how it has a karmic effect also on the future lives. That's really all it is. So if you listen to a Dhamma talk, and if that's making merit, it means that you can kind of go to sleep at night, put on the earphones and just listen to a Dhamma talk, yeah? Okay, wow, all that Dhamma, now maybe I made some merit even while sleeping. Or you turn it on, you don't really listen to it properly. The purpose of listening to the Dhamma is to learn about the Buddhist teachings, is to inspire yourself, to enable you to make the practice, yeah? This is what it's about. And if you bring them alive in that way, in the sense that you actually practice these things properly, then they certainly turn into merit, but only through your agency, through the way you live, and through the way you act. To think of listening to the Dhamma as making merit, there is really nothing about that in the suttas at all. If so, would you lead us in sharing the merits with all beings after each Dhamma talk? At the very end of the retreat, we will share the merits, yeah, with everyone, because then we have practiced the path, we have done all the right things, we have kind of been living a good life for 9 days and developing our minds, then we have some merit to share. So let's wait till the end of retreat, and then we will share the merit. I recall you had mentioned the Buddha said it is impossible not to have someone related being in the lower realm who will benefit from us sharing the merits. Thanks very much, Adan. We met. Yes, so let's do that at the end of the retreat. Please remind me at the end, and then we'll do the sharing of the merit at that point. Okay. Greetings, Ajahn Ramali. May I apply to be your new PR officer? Okay, we shall see. You have to apply, first of all, and then we will consider your application in due course, and we will get back to you. How about one package? I package you with this. Okay, here we are. Brahmali from the wild, adventurous Viking clan, etc., since you are from Norway. Okay, yeah. Let me consider that, yeah? Do let me know when is your next talk or retreat. Oops, the hall might not accommodate all after this with metta and laughs. Okay. Okay. So good. So yeah. So let's see what happens. Yeah, and then we will kind of get this sorted out, I guess, in due course, and then we will take it from there. So I'm not sure the PR officer. We shall, you know, if that is really required or not. We'll see how things go. So okay. Maybe what we should do... No, I'm not even going to go there because it's too dangerous. Okay. Okay, next one. Hello, Ajahn Brahmali. The Buddha declared his key teachings as the 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas that we just looked at before. Yet don't you think it is such an odd list? Sati, the four strivings, all repeated in the Eightfold Path anyway. The odd Iddhipada is hardly talked about in the rest of the suttas, except that chapter in the Sutta Sanghita Nikaya, and how it has to do with the Buddha's lives for an eon, etc. The five indriyas and five balas are basically the same, and again repeated factors like energy, sati, samadhi, both in the Eightfold Path and the 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas itself. Is it something profound about its sequence or its seeming oddness? Yes, you are right. It is quite odd in many ways. I suspect that the reason why it is there, remember the Buddha often uses synonyms a lot. He uses duplication of things. He says the same things again and again in different ways. And when you have a lot of synonyms, when you have a lot of overlap in teachings, you tend to stabilize the teachings. It's much less likely that something would fall away. If you just had the Noble Eightfold Path, it might get corrupted somehow. Yeah, it might more easily get corrupted. But if you have all the 37 Bodhipakadhammas with a lot of overlap, with a lot of redundancy built into it, then actually you have also more stability in what the core teachings of the Buddha are. So when you have the Satipatthanas both as a separate category, but also as the seventh factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, the same with the right effort, yeah, the sixth factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, you have built-in redundancy. And that is kind of very common for these kind of suttas because it enables a more likelihood, greater likelihood of these teachings being transmitted over the long run. Remember, the Buddha had this idea from the beginning that these suttas are going to have to live for a long time to be for the benefit of humanity and devas for a long time into the future. The balas and the faculties, again, it might be a similar kind of thing. Yeah, the idea is to bring in everything to make sure, absolutely sure, nobody gets it wrong. In this case, there is, again, very large redundancy because they are essentially the same thing. The Idipadas, they may be an important teaching. They are quite minor, you're quite right about that. You find them in certain places in the suttas, but they're not as, certainly not as pronounced as most of these other Bodhipakkhadhammas. But they may be, depending on your, remember, people have different qualities. Yeah, people have different mental predispositions and all of etc. etc. So for some people, the Idipadas may be very useful because of how they develop samadhi or whatever. So it really, the idea, of course, also is to have a comprehensive path that is useful for everyone. So these might be some of the reason why it is there. But you are right. It is a little bit odd and it is redundant. And really, that is why I said, all you have to do is come back to the Noble Eightfold Path. That makes it so easy. You only have to remember 8 things instead of remembering 37 things. Can you all remember 8 things? Yeah, you can. Okay, one person can. Okay, usually you can, after a while, you kind of get these 8 things. Yeah, but to make it even easier, you can just kind of make it even simpler. Remember only one thing. Yeah, especially in daily life, remember one thing. Remember to be kind. That will take you a long, long way down the path. But the problem is, sometimes you even forget that one thing. You know what I mean? In daily life, you get really busy, you're working really hard, doing things. Yeah, you forget even that one thing. And that is kind of the hard part of this life, is to keep on reminding ourselves, keep on being committed to these things, because only then do they become really powerful and useful. And that is why it is so useful to go on retreats every now and again, to hear the Dhamma every now and again, to remind you and recommit you to this path. So, that's all I have to say about that. Okay, dear Ajahn Brahmali, thank you for your teaching on the sutta as well. Explain, sadhu, 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 please. Can you also explain the Metta Sutta, which we chant in all retreats? Thank you kindly. Deeply appreciate it. Yes, I can explain the Metta Sutta, but the list of suttas is already very long. I was very worried when I put it together. Am I going to get through all of these suttas? Maybe not. If I add the Metta Sutta on top of that, then it might get too much. Let's see what happens. Yeah, and maybe we can put it down for next time retreat. If you want to come back to my retreat in the future, if you enjoy this one, you want to come back next time, don't know yet, but you will know hopefully at the end of the retreat, then write to me and say, please, next time, let's put the Metta Sutta in there, and we can probably do that. Because you're quite right, the Metta Sutta is actually very nice and a very important part of these teachings as well. So it's a good point. Maybe I'll put a little note aside just to take you really seriously about this, so we can leave it over there. Thank you, Ajahn. Could you please briefly speak on the importance of kindness towards oneself whilst on the path? So could you please briefly speak on the importance of kindness towards oneself whilst on the path? Okay. Idea of kindness towards oneself. One of the most kind of significant things about kindness towards oneself is that if you are kind to others, kindness to yourself often comes automatically. It comes as part of that because you get used to the idea of being kind. You get used to the idea of being generous towards others, giving the benefit of the doubt. And it's impossible to compartmentalize that completely. So you're just kind to others and you're really nasty towards yourself. Yeah, it doesn't really work like that. If you are honestly kind to others, not just superficially, but coming from the heart, yeah, in a really kind way, that will also be to your own benefit as well. So it is really as you develop kindness to others, the kindness to yourself also comes. So I would say if you're going to be kind to yourself, then I would say some of the most important things is to know, for example, the limits of how much you should work, to know to take time off to recharge your batteries, for example. There comes a point when there's just too much going on in your life and you need to have a sense of, you need to withdraw a little bit to recharge yourself, to be able to continue practicing the path. And I think these are some of the most powerful ways of being kind to yourself. Ensure that your life has quality, that you are making progress in these teachings. It's very interesting that in the suttas, the Buddha says at least in one place that the person who is practicing better is the one who is practicing for their own welfare rather than just for the welfare of others. Yeah, so if you should choose between practicing for your own welfare or for the welfare of others, you should actually choose your own welfare. It's very interesting. Why is that? Well, the reason is because it is easier to do something for yourself than it is to do something for others. You know yourself, you know your mind, you know you can do something for yourself. It is not so obvious that we can influence others. Moreover, if you do something right for yourself, you become an example. Yeah, your example becomes powerful to others. You know you have something to teach because you walk the path yourself. You have pulled yourself out of the mud. That is the time to pull other people out of the mud. That's another beautiful simile from the suttas found in the Saleka Sutta in Majjhima Nikaya number 8. The idea of pulling someone else, pulling yourself out of the mud before you try to pull somebody someone else out. The ideal person is the one who practices both for their own benefit and for the benefit of others. That is the ideal person. But it is more important to look after yourself first and then others, people usually come afterwards. So make sure that you are able to practice these teachings. Make sure you have enough room in your life to be able to take a break, to be able to do some meditation practice, to kind of rebalance yourself in your ordinary life. Yeah, make sure that you have the ability to be kind in your life. Once you lose your ability to be kind, you know that you are too stressed. You know that there's too many things happening. Withdraw a little bit. Get back into the right balance again. Yeah. Once you get back into the right balance and the kindness reemerges, you have the ability to live well again, then you know that you are on the right track. Yeah? So just look at your mind state. Know your limitations. Know if you have the ability to make progress on the path. As long as you have that ability, you have enough energy, you have the right qualities. And that is how I reckon you are kind to yourself. Another way to be kind to yourself is to learn to forgive yourself. How do you learn to forgive yourself? And the way to do that is just as I was mentioning before, the idea of conditioning. Yeah, we can understand how other people are conditioned to be what they are. We also are conditioned to be what we are. Yeah, in a very large part, sometimes you get upset about things. Why do you get upset about things? Well, very often, not because you choose to become upset, not because you want to be upset, but it's just an automatic reaction to the circumstances. The more you understand that you are, a lot of the time, you're just automatically reacting to the circumstances around you, the more compassion you can have for yourself, because you realize you are not the autonomous person that you thought you were. It's counterintuitive because we feel autonomous. Yeah, we feel that we have the choice to do things. But if you look at yourself carefully, you realize actually the autonomy, if there is any at all, is very, very small. Usually we react before we have a chance even to think about what we're doing. It is the habits, it is our usual way of being that usually comes out in us. And the more you see that in yourself, the more ability you have to forgive yourself. That is another way of being kind towards yourself. This doesn't mean that you can do whatever you like, yeah? I can do whatever I like because afterwards I can just forgive myself, yeah? Ha! I found the way out. Don't have to be virtuous. Please don't think like that because that doesn't work. Why? Because the problem is that because as long as you have a sense of self, you will feel responsible for what you do, at least to some extent. Forgiveness can only go so far. There will always be a residue of responsibility that you feel that you are responsible for that. That is what the sense of self does. The sense of self owns your actions. It says, I did this, therefore I must reap the consequences. It's impossible to forgive yourself 100%, and that's why virtue, morality, kindness is so important. Yeah, you can't beat the system, yeah, by being super smart. If you try, you are in trouble. Oh, here we have an essay, okay. So let's see. Dear Ajahn, thank you so much for the amazing, super brainwashing sutta teaching. Could you please provide your view on the following? Okay, question number one. What is the main difference between Theravada and other Buddhist traditions, such as Mahayana, in terms of sutta teachings? Also, is the belief of bodhisattvas in Mahayana tradition incorrect in the Buddha's teachings? Okay, so I will answer this in fairly briefly. In terms of the sutta teachings, the difference is that the Mahayana tradition usually relies on suttas that are much later than the earliest suttas. Yeah, and in a sense, the Theravada tradition does the same. Theravada also often relies on later things because Theravada often relies on Abhidhamma. It relies on Visuddhimagga. It relies on commentaries. It relies on all these other things that were written a long time after the Buddha. So all branches of Buddhism really tend to rely on later texts. Yeah, this is a universal problem. So when we talk about the Mahayana tradition, let's talk about, for example, the Buddhist tradition in China, in the Chinese, translated into Chinese. Now, if you look at the Chinese suttas, the Chinese canon is enormous, yeah, absolutely massive, hundreds of volumes. And part of that, of those hundreds of volumes, is a small little section, which is the early suttas, and they correspond roughly to the suttas we have in Pali language. Yeah, so they exist in Chinese translation. They are there. And some of the Mahayana monks, there's a very famous Mahayana monk from Taiwan called Master Yinshun, I can't pronounce it properly. I have to apologize for that. But something like Master Yinshun, very famous in Taiwan, and he passed away a few years ago. But he is kind of one of the most influential Mahayana monks in Taiwan. He was the kind of the person who influenced the Fo Guan Shan, the very large monasteries, and they have monasteries around the world, Buddha Light International, whatever they're called. Dharma Drum Mountain is another big organization in Taiwan. Su Chi Foundation is another big foundation in Taiwan, and he was basically the inspiration behind all of that. And he was also considered one of the greatest scholars in Taiwan. And he said, if you want to go back and find the real teachings of the Buddha, he said this, yeah, he's a Mahayana monk, you have to go to the early suttas. Because they exist also in Chinese translation, the Agamas. So basically, if you are inquisitive and you want to find out where the earliest teachings are, what the teachings of the Buddha are, if you are inquisitive enough, you will eventually be directed back to these particular suttas that we find in the four Nikayas, regardless of what tradition you come from. But generally speaking, the Mahayana tradition focuses more on later suttas, suttas such as the Prajnaparamita Sutta, the Perfection of Wisdom Sutta, and a lot of other things that exist in the Mahayana tradition. And they're not necessarily wrong, right? There are many things in there which may be right, which may be in accordance with the early teachings, but maybe not everything. And certainly the idea of the bodhisattva path is not really found in the earliest teachings. So the idea of bodhisattva in the Mahayana tradition is not really part of the Buddha's teaching. Buddha's teaching is about enlightenment through becoming an arahant. Number two, I heard people converted to the Christianity because the person recovered from sickness as a result of family members praying to God to help. Ajahn Brahm did mention some people who were sick recovered from his chanting. I do not believe in Christianity. The God helped recover the sick. Ajahn Brahm mentioned his chanting gave people a lift, and that helps sometimes. What is your view on this? This is interesting, yeah, and I think it is possible that if you pray for someone, it may actually help them. Yeah, it may not have anything to do with God. It is just that if you send someone goodwill, if you send someone something positive, just like you do some chanting for somebody, especially if you tell them, because if you tell them, you will have the placebo effect. You know the placebo effect in medicine? Placebo effect is that, in case you don't know, is the idea that if you give someone the medicine or you give them a sugar pill, yeah, the sugar pill also has an effect. Yeah, it is empty, there's no medicine in there, but it has an effect. Why? Because you believe that you've been given a medicine. That belief is enough. Even if you know it is a placebo, even if you know it's not the real thing, still it has an effect. This has been proven, you know, in science. That's why you always have to, when you have trials in medicine, you always have to have the trials against the placebo effect to see that the medicine has an effect beyond that of the placebo. So when you do chanting, at the very least, you have the placebo effect. So that's why you always tell somebody, we're doing some chanting for you. And they say, oh, thank you very much. That will already be helpful. Does it have any help beyond that? And I think quite likely it does. Very hard to quantify. There have been many studies done on people with praying. They have had these double-blind experiments done in the US whether praying is effective or not. And the results are a bit ambiguous. I'm not sure if the results are clear at all. But it is possible that there is an effect there. But I personally, I don't think it has anything to do with a God. It has to do with direct mind-to-mind between the people praying and the people receiving the benefit of the prayer. Yeah, got nothing to do with God being involved at all. That is my view of the matter here. Mahayana tradition has a lot of mantras which do not exist in Theravada tradition. What do the mantras do and where do they come from? So mantras come from many different things, yeah? All kind of things. They are often gathas, in other words, stanzas, or verses found in the suttas. And these verses are then used as mantras. And this is also common in the Theravada tradition. We don't do it here, but you will find it's very common in Theravada countries. You will chant a certain mantra as a charm to help people and to protect them. And what is interesting, yeah, this is kind of scary. If you are into black magic, what you do is you reverse the mantra and you say it backwards, and then it becomes like a dark mantra instead. Don't try that, yeah? I've warned you. But this is apparently what people do, yeah? And if you, again, if you believe in these things, it has like a negative placebo effect. I think it's called the nocebo effect or something like that. It's a negative placebo where it actually does affect you simply by knowing that somebody is doing something bad towards you. So these mantras are often gathas. They are taken out of the suttas, taken out of these things, and then chanted as a consequence, as charms. So what do they do? You can use mantras in different ways. One of the ways you can use the mantra is as a meditation object. So you can have a very simple mantra like Buddha. Buddha is a very commonly used in Thailand, for example. You say Bud on the in-breath and Do on the out-breath, for example. And if you have a very kind of feeling of a close connection with the Buddha, it can often give rise to very wholesome states of mind, unify the mind, and move you towards samadhi, at least initially. So this is often how they are used, at least in a wholesome way. And if you understand the meaning, very often in Mahayana tradition, they will chant in Mandarin in Chinese, yeah, so they will often understand what is being chanted. And then, of course, it can be very useful as well. Okay, last question for tonight. Dear Ajahn, thank you for your teachings. Can you please explain again about right effort, right concentration? Ooh, right stillness, yeah? And right mindfulness. The difference between mindfulness and stillness. Many thanks. Okay, so the difference between mindfulness and stillness, between samadhi and sati. Sati is mindfulness. Samadhi is stillness, concentration, immersion, whatever you want to call it. The difference is that sati is just the ability to be present. Yeah, so if you are really present now, you're really here, that is already a degree of sati. If your mind is wandering all over the place, then you don't have any sati. That sati can have many different degrees. The degree of presence can vary enormously. Yeah, so you want to build up the sati to become as powerful as possible. Present moment awareness. But it's not yet focused. It is still going from one thing to another one. Yeah, you are here, now I see the lights, now I see the sign over there, now I see the floor. Yeah, so sati is still moving. The mind isn't unified yet. So that is what stillness is about. First of all, the mindfulness arises. You are in the present moment. And then you focus on an object which unifies the mind. The mind becomes still. The mind becomes unified around that object. That is what stillness is. Yeah. So stillness is a development on mindfulness. First you have mindfulness. You have to have mindfulness first. Stillness can only arise out of mindfulness. Or I should say, right stillness can only arise out of right mindfulness. You can never have stillness first. If you have stillness first without mindfulness, then it is called sleeping. Yeah, it's a different thing here. So, first of all, mindfulness, then stillness comes as a consequence afterwards. So right effort, right mindfulness, and right stillness. How does this work? So, to enable yourself to be mindful, yeah, to be able to be in the present moment, you cannot have too many defilements in the mind, because the defilements in the mind take you out of the present moment. If you desire something, you go into the future. If you have ill will, often you go into the past. Yeah, these things lead you out of the present moment. The less you have of defilements in the mind, the more present you are, the more powerful mindfulness is. So the job of right effort is to think in such a way, to perceive in such a way, to learn to be in such a way that the defilements in the mind go down until the point comes where mindfulness is strong enough that you can start to do meditation practice. When the defilements are low enough, at that point, mindfulness is strong enough, you can do meditation because you are able to be aware of the breath. If you come in here straight off the street, you know, straight off Perth from work or whatever, you are tired, you're thinking about all kind of stuff, it's impossible to watch the breath, yeah? It just can't be done because the mind is all over the place. So you need time to settle down, to get the defilements kind of, you know, shuffled away somewhere, get rid of those defilements. Then the mindfulness starts to kick in. Yeah, and very often for many people, it can take years of practice, years of just being kind, years to learn how to think in the right way before you have enough mindfulness to even watch the breath properly. Many people do mindfulness of breathing and they're not really ready for that. This is one of the problems in meditation, going to the breath too quickly. Before you go to the breath, you should establish mindfulness first, then you go to the breath. Most people, they sit down and start watching the breath straight away. And that is actually the wrong way to go about that. And then, as you are watching the breath, yeah, the defilements go down. There's still some very subtle defilements there in the mind as you watch the breath. By watching the breath, the defilements get less and less. Why is that? Because by watching the breath, you are no longer feeding the defilements. The defilements of the mind can only exist if you feed them. Feeding them means thinking about things that you desire, thinking about people you don't like, so you have ill will. Whatever it is, that feeds the defilements. If all you're doing is watching the breath, the fuel for the defilements is gone. So gradually, they become less and less and less. Yeah, and eventually, you overcome them completely. This is satipatthana. This is right mindfulness. It happens through the very simple act of watching the breath. Then the joy comes and all of these other things comes. And as they arise, you're getting closer and closer to right stillness until eventually you enter the jhanas based on that joy, based on the lights and based on all of those kind of things. Yeah, makes sense. It's beautiful, isn't it? Once you start to get the hang of this, it's actually very obvious. It has to work this way. It's not that hard to understand. All you have to do is to do it. That is the hardest part, to commit, to be persevere. But as you do so, you will find the way to all the beauty that the Dhamma is able to supply in this life and beyond. What a wonderful thing that is. Okay, so that is all for tonight. So let us pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha as usual, and then have a good night, have a nice rest, and then we'll see you again tomorrow morning. Yeah.
Yeah. I just remember there is that Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta in the Pajjima
Nikaya. Ah, yeah, Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta.
The
yeah.
Venerable Pukkusati's,
yeah.
The potter's workshop.
Yeah.
I think in that it says six elements.
It does,
I thought. It came to my mind, but
yeah.
I was not sure.
It could be a reference to that, yeah, the four elements or whatever. Yeah.
I think six elements.
Six, yeah.
Plus Buddha adds two other elements. Consciousness and the space
element, exactly. Yeah,
so
yeah.
Those six. I think yeah. Maybe that is the one question.
Could be
about that.
Yeah, sure.
Sorry. Okay.